was an English major and had no particular career plan. And so after, this was in the Boston area, so after I graduated, I worked as a travel agent for a few years. And then quite by accident, I got a job doing hematology research at Boston City Hospital. And that's how I got interested in medicine. The woman I worked for and the head of the unit, a woman physician, right around World War II, and she was a real pioneer in terms of women physician leaders, hired me with very little science background to do research on sickle cell anemia and G60D deficiency. And following the patients in our clinics and the patients who donated blood for us, the patients with sickle cell anemia, was really how I got interested in medicine and in doing something beyond lab work, which I enjoyed, but was pretty devoid of people most of the time. So a friend who was a resident told me about the physician assistant program in Boston at Northeastern. I'd never heard about PAs. This was 1974, and I investigated and applied to three programs and was accepted at the Hahnemann PA program in Philadelphia, and started in 75 and graduated in 77. So that was, Hahnemann was the first PA program in Philadelphia and the first PA program in Pennsylvania, and it was one of a group of programs that started after the first, they were sort of the first wave. After Duke started up in and at University of Washington, MedX in Seattle, the federal government put some money into training grants to start PA programs. So Hahnemann was one of a number that got some grant money and got started. And when I graduated, 1977, it's really funny, there were literally no jobs. Our challenge as new PA graduates was to go create jobs, because people really didn't know who we were and what we did. And I was fortunate enough to be offered a job on the PA program faculty, which was, you know, the program was growing in terms of numbers of students. They knew they needed more PAs to teach. And it wasn't unusual then for people to start on the faculty right out of the PA program. It's relatively uncommon now for good reason. Back then, there weren't many of us. So they chose me, and I thought, well, that sounds like fun. I don't have another job. I never thought of being a teacher, but who knows? My original plan, coming to the PA program, I moved to Philadelphia from Boston. The group of people that I was living with in a sort of communal household arrangement, and we'd all planned to go to live in the South, ironically not very far from Knoxville, where we intended to go. And I had this vision of myself sort of riding around on horseback with my little black bag, offering health care to poor people up in the hills, folks from your college. So I took the job and stayed in Philadelphia for 25 years. Like many of us who started working in PA programs right out of school, we all worked part-time clinically, which I did in internal medicine and family medicine. Along the way, I worked part-time for the first staff model HMO in Philadelphia. Staff models HMOs, as you know, are like Kaisers, and they were basically unknown on the East Coast. And in fact, it didn't last very long. It wasn't a very viable corporation for that time. And I started at the program as admissions coordinator and then became curriculum coordinator. And the program director left in 1984, and I became the interim director, and then was appointed the regular director in 85. And the story behind that was that she left, she was not a PA, and she had been a really good mentor for me. Her name was Evelyn Major, and she was the wife of one of the physicians, Dave Major, who helped found the PA program there at Hahnemann. Take the job, and I thought she couldn't possibly be serious because I didn't think I was ready or qualified, and I'd never really thought about that. But the choice for me, I thought, was either taking the job and learning how to do it or taking a chance that they might hire somebody that I didn't want, that I wouldn't get along with and didn't want to report to. I really loved the program, and I was in the business of making it better and making it a good experience for students. Like a lot of us who come onto PA faculties, almost everybody wants to make the program better and wants students to have a better experience than they had. Not that my experience was miserable, it's just that I thought it could have been better. And ended up staying there until 2000, so I was program director for 15 years. And I was one of the early generation of women who were named program director, who came up through the ranks of our own programs. Ruth Baldwin in Seattle at the University of Washington, and Bonnie Schmidt, who's now Bonnie Vedic, at the Medical College of Georgia, did it almost the same time. Ruth Ballweg, B-A-L-L-W-E-G, and Bonnie Vedic, D-A-D-I-G, she's now Bonnie Schmidt. She married subsequently. And I'm pretty sure she's still at the Medical College of Georgia support group, because all of us were struggling with how to do this job, how to do it in an institution that was dominated by the medical school, how to do it as women in field medicine in general and still PA education at that point dominated by men. So they were really lifesavers for me, because we often talked on the phone about how to get things done, how to be politically effective. Ruth in particular is a really accomplished person, and I mean that in the best possible way. She's really smart about groups and how to get things done and how to use power in authority in a good way, in a way for the betterment of the program and the betterment of the profession. During my time at Hahnemann, it was a turbulent time. The university and hospital system was taken over by a group from Pittsburgh. The CEO drove it into bankruptcy. It was the largest nonprofit bankruptcy in American history, and may still be. There have been larger for-profit institutions going bankrupt, but that may still stand as one of the largest nonprofits. So that was a real test of leadership skills, and I was able, along with my dean and other program directors in our School of Health Sciences, to keep things going and student morale and faculty morale relatively reasonable during a time of incredible crisis. And it wasn't just crisis, it was that we had very little information most of the time. We learned what was happening at our institution from the Philadelphia Inquirer, the local paper. Virtually no communication from upper-level administration at that point. So some more leadership challenges and some more lessons learned through that one. Major one being communicate, which I always knew that was important, but learned how important and how much it mattered, particularly during that crisis. So parallel issues going on for me during that time professionally were involved in the Association of PA Programs, which became subsequently the PA Education Association, actually only fairly recently. So APAP, as we called it then, now the Association for PA Programs and for faculty to learn from each other, to share information about PA education, to share innovations, develop innovations. And I served on the board of that organization for a while. I was the chair of the education committee. All that stuff is in my CV. You can see that. I think what stands out to me about being part of APAP and then PAEA is how important it was to me, and I think most people who took advantage of the organization, to have a group of colleagues who were almost without exception generous, willing to share information, not competitive, really collegial in nature. And, you know, whether I was on a committee or representing the association or serving on the board, I just always felt like I was doing something that was valuable because we were really making a difference in education. All of us make a difference in education at our own individual programs, but when we got together, we came up with some great ideas and some new features and ways of doing things, and that really made me feel like I was making a contribution to the profession. When I was educated as a PA, the founding fathers of our program, Bill Oakes and Dave Major, both really fantastic physicians, internists, had the idea of what the PA role, which was typical for the time, except I think for people like Dr. Stead, who had a more revolutionary view of what PAs could do. People thought that we were sort of H&P technicians, that our job was to gather information, do technical procedures, you know, EKGs and so forth and so on. And so our education and the way that we were taught about the PA role had very little to do with anything that you would now think of as the PA role. We weren't taught much about diagnosis. We weren't taught much about treatment. We weren't expected to be able to function as autonomously as we ended up doing in practice, and moreover, as autonomously as the profession developed. So part of my reason for wanting to be in PA education was that when I got out into clinical practice, you know, as I said, I was still on the faculty, but I was seeing patients, and I was responsible for them in a way that I hadn't really understood that I would be. And like probably lots of new graduates, but probably for better reason then, I didn't feel really prepared. So when I worked on the faculty, part of what I was about as a curriculum, or now we call them academic coordinators, was making sure that students got an adequate preparation to be able to go out and work in the PA role as we saw it evolve and as we practiced it in reality. And I think it's almost, you know, it's really difficult to appreciate now how limited the role was perceived at that time. You know, there weren't PAs working in surgery, there weren't PAs working in ICUs or as intensivists or hospitalists or any of the roles that are just, you know, matter-of-fact routine. Yes, of course, those are part of your career choices as a PA graduate. So I feel really fortunate to have been part of those changes in the profession and part of sort of revising and improving PA education so that students and graduates could really be prepared for what they actually got to do in practice, what we got to do in practice. Had they not offered me a job on the faculty straight out of school, I have a feeling I would have ended up back in education eventually. What I found out, I mean, I think I was really lucky. This was just a lucky happenstance that I hadn't had any teaching experience, and I had to figure it all out, and I hadn't had any administrative or program director experience, and I had to figure that all out with the help of my friends. But I loved it. I loved teaching. I've always, the part of my job as program director that kept me going was being in a classroom or being in a seminar room or being in a clinical site and being with students. So I like to think I would have found my way to that at some point in my career, because it turned out it was a really great fit of it. I was pretty good at it. And it was sort of magical for me. I never, ever doubted that I was doing something worthwhile. Education, to me, is one of those precious touchstones that always matters. It matters more in some people's lives than others. PA education, I think, is really special because of the kind of people that come to PA programs as students, the kind of people that work in PA programs as faculty, and the purpose and mission that everybody's involved in. Plus the fact that it's only however long it is, 24, 27 months. When I decided to go to PA school, it was 21 months, the program I went to. And I thought, okay, well, I can stand to go back to school for that long. It's not like going to medical school, which is a lot longer, plus residency. So, I mean, I think the PA profession, for so many reasons, is just an incredible profession, incredible opportunity, amazing to be able to do as much with people's lives as we do with relatively not so much medical, not so much education. For you folks, your education is, I mean, I already had a bachelor's degree and then I went to the PA program. That didn't used to be the requirement. Now it is, and I think that's not only the trend in the profession, but probably a really good thing because the level of responsibility that you all have when you graduate meets the extra years of education. The other thing I wanted to talk about was being on the Accreditation Review Commission. I was and served on it for, I guess, 5 years. So I did a lot of accreditation site visits. I ended up being vice chair of the commission. And that was another wonderful professional experience. And actually ended up leading to what I'm doing today, what I'm doing in my life now, which is consulting with PA programs about accreditation issues. The ARC is populated with people from different backgrounds. Most majority are physicians. There's a good representation of PAs. All serve in a voluntary capacity. All work really hard and for absolutely no stipend, just travel costs reimbursed. And they work really hard because they believe in the profession and believe in PA education and want to see it improved and want to see programs do well and so forth. And they have the responsibility of evaluating PA programs to make sure that they're providing appropriate education and have the appropriate policies and procedures and processes in place to do that, everything from admissions through graduate outcomes and self-study. I really enjoyed and appreciated from that body and to do site visits and to learn about so many different PA programs. It is really a wonderful thing in our profession that the standards for program accreditation are written in a fairly broad and general way. They're specific about some things, but not very specific about curriculum, in the sense that the standards outline the important pieces that need to be in the curriculum, but they don't say in what order or how much. And what that's meant over the years, that programs could develop their own curriculum using their own resources in the context of their own mission and their own community. And it's why we've had so much innovation in PA education. And I think that has served the profession well. I know it has served programs well and students. You know, there's everything from programs that focus on rural health to programs that focus on inner city health. They're all accredited. They all meet the same standards, but they're meeting the needs of very different communities and very different sets of students with different interests. So when I left Hahnemann in 2000, I went away to New England intending to just sort of take some time off. And I knew enough people in the profession at that point in PA education that they started calling me and asking me if I could help them get ready for accreditation, which is how I ended up with the small but wonderful, small meaning me, consulting business. I did that for a few years. I took a long consulting gig at Central Michigan, which was terrific for me because I grew up in Michigan. So I got to be close to my relatives back there for a while. And then I went on my American walkabout, which was traveling around the country in my car for about a year and a half, mooching off my friends and family, thinking about where I wanted to live next. It was a lovely time. As a consultant, if you've got access to email and telephone and fax, but now really just email, you can do your work almost anywhere, and that, of course, for me is punctuated by visits to campuses and mock rehearsals for accreditation visits and so forth. But I could wander around the country and have a wonderful time traveling and still make a living. So that was really a treat. In 2005, I got a call from a longtime friend of mine from APAP, who was the associate director at Stanford because their program director was stepping down. And my son was and still is soon to be finished in grad school doing a PhD at the University of California, San Francisco. So I went to Stanford for 3 years, which again was wonderful because I was within 45 minutes driving time from him. And we could, you know, I could go up to the city and have dinner. He could come down and swim in the apartment complex's pool. And the Stanford program is a really special, special program that I enjoyed. I just think so much of those folks. They require a whole lot of healthcare experience before people start, and the curriculum is a mix of didactic and clinical. So there's constant reinforcement of the classroom didactic with clinical experiences. Very strong mission in primary care and great outcomes of graduates working in primary care and medically underserved communities. So that was a really intense but wonderful 3 years. And at the end of it, I had figured out where I wanted to live, which is Riggins, Idaho. This is a town of with a population of 400. A about 3 hours north of Boise. It sits right on the Salmon River, and I'm here because my brother is here. My brother is a retired dock who got into whitewater rafting and got trained as a guide, and Briggins is a whitewater rafting center. So I moved here a couple years ago and went back to my consulting business. So as we speak, I am sitting in the beautiful river canyon of the Salmon River, and I'll be doing several rafting trips this summer. The deer graze in my backyard. The apricots are right on the tree in my backyard, so the deer have been hanging around a lot. And it's, again, I have a phone and email so I can do my work from here and then go traveling when I need to be at various people's campuses. It's a pretty pretty ideal lifestyle. I'm assistant of guide to clinical practice, which I was one of the three editors of for Stream Edition. Ruth Baldwick, who I mentioned earlier, was approached, and I can't even remember, but this is back in the 90s. Yeah, must be 90s. By one of the senior allied health editors at Saunders Publishing about doing a book specifically for PA students. And yeah, understanding the historical background for that is really interesting. For all those years in PA education, there were no textbooks for PA students. In PA education, we use students in, textbooks intended for medical students or nursing students, primarily those two groups. And would have to tell students, you know, where it says medical student, think PA student, and where it says nursing student, think PA student, because there were no textbooks for PA students. Lisa, her last name will come back to me before we're done with this, who worked at Saunders, had been watching the PA profession develop, and there were a couple more PA programs in Philadelphia by that point, and she believed that there was finally a critical mass in the number of PA students, the number of PA programs, to be able to make a profitable entree into publishing for PAs. And so she and Ruth got together and had the idea for this book, and Ruth asked me, and our third editor was Ed Sullivan, who at the time was the program director of the UT Dallas program, and then subsequently, an addition later, went into back into clinical practice. So the three of us were in different parts of the country, Ruth in Seattle, me in Philadelphia, Ed in Dallas. And Ed came with surgical experience, where Ruth and I had more primary care experience. So Ed had a strong military background, so we thought we made a pretty good fit. And we worked, the first edition we put together, we had decided it was going to be an edited book with various chapter authors, and we had a tiny little bit of upfront money from Saunders, and we used it to get together and work together. The rest of the time, we worked separately and communicated by email and passed chapters around either by email or mail. They gave us, once the book was approaching being done, they gave us what's called the developmental editor, which is somebody that does copy, proofwriting, not much editing. We really did the editing. And the first book was the first PA book, the first book published for a uniquely PA audience, other than the books preceding that had been books like the one by Sadler and Bliss, and the one by another author, his name I forget, which were about the PA profession and were sort of research about how the profession had developed in history and so forth. This was the first book that was meant for PA students with information about content areas everything from H&P information to the practice of PAs in surgery, which I thought was, to new areas, new emerging areas for PA practice. I mean, it was sort of soup to nuts, and because there wasn't anything like it. And so for me, that was, you know, it was another lucky opportunity to be part of something that really made a difference in PA education. Because what happened was that it was published, it was a paperback, it was not perfect, it had, you know, some typos and errors in it, but it made money for Saunders. The editors never get much money when you do this kind of stuff. Their authors get virtually nothing. This is all, you know, people doing it for the love of it and wanting to contribute and, you know, and wanting to be in a book. But it made money for Saunders, and everybody in the medical publishing industry took note. And within, you know, within 5 to 10 years, there were a lot of assorted textbooks out for PAs. So you all are using, I'm sure, a variety of them. And now there's everything from clinical procedures. The board review books came along fairly soon. Before that, everybody was using medical school National Board Part 2 review books. So it was, you know, it was one of these projects that was a ton of work. When they came back to us again for the second edition, all three of us thought, oh, no, but yes, we want to, yes, we have to, and the third edition, and each one got better each time. Saunders, which became Elsevier, gave us more technical support and more copy editing and so forth, so each edition was better than the last. I bailed out on the fourth edition, which I think is even better than the first three editions, and Ruth and Ed brought in a couple of new editors, both of whom I think are just terrific. So it was a ton of work in addition to everything else that I was doing, but the fact that you all have books, a variety of books to choose from, or that your instructors have a variety of books to choose from that are written for PAs. It came along at a time that I was taking on the job at Stanford. In other words, I was going back to being a program director, which is an incredibly intensive, demanding job. And I knew I wanted to save whatever spare time I had to be with my son. And so it just, you know, it was time for me to bow out, and it was time. I take great pride that they replaced me with two people. it was time for new people to get involved. Ruth recognized that, too, that, you know, when you have a project like that, like anything any of us are doing in volunteer work or professional organizations or in PA programs, we should always be looking for our successors. We should always be looking for who's going to take this on, you know, if it's, whether it's this book, if it continues in subsequent editions, you know, who's going to take this on, who's going to be the next chapter president, who's going to be the next set of delegates to the House of Delegates, all those kinds of leadership training and leadership opportunities. People in the PA world, I think, do pretty well because it's still a relatively small world, and people are aware that we always need to be looking towards the future and thinking about who's coming up, who is willing and able to do it. Oh, that brings me to another thing. Somewhere along this line, you'll find the dates in my CV. I was asked to chair the Leadership Advisory Commission for the AAPA, and that was another really terrific, really interesting experience. And what our small group did was create the toolbox format for the PA AAPA website, along with a whole lot of links to varying leadership kinds of materials, and we did a bunch of other things. The reason I thought of it is one of the things that I learned while sharing that was that we did a lot of interviews and talking and chatting and just sharing stories with people who were in leadership positions both at the state and national level in the PA profession, and found that almost without exception, the way that people got into those positions or got started in leadership was that someone tapped them on the shoulder and said, I think you'd be good at this. Hardly anybody came to it out of their own sort of ambition. Lots of people, when tapped, decided that they really wanted to do it and found their role and found their joy in it. But it was one of those lessons about always keep looking around you for people who can do this job and maybe do it better. and keep the ball rolling and make sure that new people and younger people and people who are newer to the profession get into the ranks of leadership, because that's where our future is. Improving PA education and my sense of humor. Students always come first. Actually, make that part of the first. I want to be remembered for helping to improve PA education, for reminding myself and everybody that the students always come first. And then if they remember my sense of humor, that would be nice too. Yeah, I think the textbook that Ruth and Ed and I did is worth being remembered for, because it was really a first in the field. I would like to be remembered as a consultant who is program-centered. I want programs to be the best that they can possibly be, but in their own model, using their own mission. I don't have a belief about every PA program should look the same way, and this is the way you have to do it, and this is the way you should do it. So, like working with students with different learning styles, I work with programs that are in different stages of development and maturity, everything from new programs to well-established programs, and mostly with program directors who are new in their jobs, which reminds me of when I was new in my job and I wished I'd had a consultant. So that's a really long thing, but I'd like to be remembered as a consultant who worked with programs to make them the best they could be, not in a model that I was trying to force on them. I would like to be remembered I'd like to be remembered as a teacher, because I've loved teaching. I've been pretty good at it, and it's been a real joy for me to see the lights go on, either one-on-one or in a seminar or in a classroom, when I can explain something and when I can stretch people's knowledge and reasoning and understanding. And I would also, as a teacher, I think self-knowledge is one of the most important parts of being a PA, being any kind of professional. And so part of my teaching has been in the behavioral sciences, because I believe that people are better practitioners when they know, are aware, and have learned to deal with their own beliefs and values and biases, which we all have, and have learned to how to compensate for those, not, set them aside for the sake of the patient, not become a different person, but to really be with the patient. I would like to be remembered as a teacher, as someone who said, just sit down and listen. It's one of the most therapeutic and valuable things that we can do as PAs with our patients. I would like to be remembered as, we must be up to 10 now, I'm running out. To me, it's always far more interesting to hear how other people remember other people than how they remember or want to be remembered themselves. I mean, you know, I have my own idea of my career. Here's number 10. That I was on the leading edge of women PA program directors in the profession, which is, has now become a fairly standard. First of all, when I started in the profession, there were very few PAs who were program directors. Most of them were physicians, understandably, because they started the profession. And a few other kinds of professionals were all very good at what they did. So I was on the cusp of the recognition that there were enough PAs who could be leaders, who could be program directors, and women who were appointed program directors. So that was pretty cool. There was a low level of routine sexual, what would now be considered sexual harassment, that pervaded the medical community. I'm obviously not the only person to say this from this era. So it's almost, there was nothing really dramatic, but there was constant suggestions, denigrations, and I know from talking to women of my era that we all lived with that. We're at various times angry, resigned, frustrated, desensitized, resensitized. I mean, it was sort of just part of the background noise. And it was true it was particularly true clinically, less true for me in education, but it was there because we were part of a medical school, an academic health center that pervaded the academic health center. It was just the day-to-day grind of having to deal with it. And I probably was lucky that I became a PA in my late 20s because I had been through enough work experiences at that point and had dealt with enough of that stuff that my anger antenna were not nearly as sensitive as they had been, and my ability to sort of negotiate and get through and stand my own ground without being confrontational in situations where it would have hurt me to be confrontational, I sort of perfected a lot of those skills, not by choice, but by necessity. I feel like as a teacher, I've gotten to influence so many PAs. That's just incredibly rewarding, and I feel like I've been able to touch the lives of students and, by extension, the patients and the families and the communities that they take care of, and that just means everything to me. I was in my late 20s and, as I said, working as a hematology research technician, and which is how I got interested in medicine. I was not somebody who, put Band-Aids on dolls or early interest in medicine. I got interested because of the job that I had, and I started going to grand rounds, and I started hanging around with the docs and the residents and the fellows in our hematology group. And it was a time in my life when I realized that I wanted to do more. I had the confidence that I was capable of doing more, and that, you know, the PA profession, the idea of it, came along at just the right time for me. It was like serendipity. I didn't, you know, it's not like I had college, high school or college counselors suggesting it, because when I was in high school, there wasn't a PA, and certainly not in college either. I just kind of stumbled across it in my quest to find something to do in medicine. I'd actually, before I applied to PA programs, I really was interested in becoming a nurse midwife, but I would have had to go back to school and go back to nursing school and then go to midwifery school, and that looked like it was going to take too long. So it was, I consider my professional life to be a series of wonderful accidents and an ability to recognize an opportunity when it comes along and open the door and walk through it and take a risk. We had a didactic curriculum, although it was fairly short. Our clinical medicine course was with our class sat in a room and watched videotapes of lectures that had been given to medical students, which was not a particularly wonderful way to learn, although we learned it from a lot of really skilled and knowledgeable people. There was a lot of emphasis in our didactic education on H&Ps. We did a complete handwritten, and you know what a complete H&P was like. We did a complete handwritten H&P write-up on a patient in the hospital every week for, I can't remember, 7, 8, 9 months, something like that. And so those exercises sort of dominated our lives, because you know how long they take. First of all, you know how long it takes to find a patient in a hospital and then to get them to, you know, give you as much information as you need for a complete H&P and then writing it up. So, you know, our education was very much geared toward the role that they expected us to have, which was largely around data gathering, not so much about assessment and plan. It was about the S and the O, not the A and the P. There were elements of treatment. We didn't have a separate pharmacology course, but we had stuff on treatment. We had stuff on basic sciences, although we did not have a separate anatomy course. We had sort of a combined anatomy physiology with no lab course. It was so early in the profession, it's almost hard for you guys to imagine, and it's even hard for me to imagine. Emphasis in the curricula then, and this is fairly universal, this is not, I don't want you to think that Hahnemann was particularly archaic. They were just doing what everybody else was doing, which is figuring it out as they go along. And what they were doing was, it was an accredited program, and they were following the trends of the time. Our clinical rotations, you know, were really the meat and potatoes of where we learned everything, because, well, our didactic preparation didn't do as much as it might have about assessment and plan, our clinical education did it. And so that was really invaluable. I remember as a student wondering at regular intervals what I had gotten myself into. What was I thinking? I remember feeling stupid a lot. I remember failing my first set of tests because I've been an English major in college, and I was used to writing papers. When they gave us these tests, it was like a big wake-up call, and I said to myself, oh, I get it. They want me to learn facts. This is about knowledge and facts. Okay, well, I can do that. And I did real well after that. I just had to readjust. And I tell students, when I was a program director and faculty member, I would tell students that story every year, because, you know, the first set of tests is just to kind of figure out what they want, what they expect, what you're doing, and then you make adjustments and go on. I, as a program director, I really tried to remember what it had been like for me to be a student and what it was like for any student to be a student, which is about the imbalance of power and authority, about having been an adult and having people that you don't know and not necessarily have any reason to trust telling you what to do and how to do it 24 hours a day, at least it felt like that to me. And so students put up with a lot from faculty. Faculty put up with a lot from students. And as a faculty member and program director, I thought it was really important to remember that students had a life before PA school. They will have a life after PA school. And unless they prove otherwise, they should be treated as competent adults. And having said that, the balance of power is not ever in favor of the students. I never worked in a program where, students were treated badly deliberately, but things happen sometimes. Part of my wish for the PA profession is that we continue the commitment to primary care and medically underserved communities, whether they're rural or urban, and underserved populations, and really try to address health disparities in the primary care sector. And I think that not just because it's the roots of the profession, but it's because what the country really needs. If you look at the state of our primary care, quote-unquote, system, it's in a shambles, and healthcare reform hasn't kicked in yet, and I'm not sure how it's going to kick in exactly. But it's very clear that we need more primary care providers, and I would like a lot of them to be PAs. Now, having said that, I also think it's just fabulous that PAs are working in all of these amazing specialties and in intensivist roles and roles that I couldn't have imagined when I started as a PA, and nobody else could either, by the way. I would like to see those options, both the primary care side and the specialty side, continue and both be valued for the contributions that they make, and let the profession value both without being adversarial about either. And I would really think, I think one of the most important and wonderful things about the profession is being able to have lateral mobility and change from specialty to specialty, from primary to specialty, from special to primary care, without having to go back and retrain. But a key to that, of course, is our supervisory relationship with physicians. And that's really the key to the profession and to our, there is no other profession where you can change specialties the way we do and not have to go back and do a residency or another certification or another, another program. And I really hope the profession maintains that. He bought a bunch of boats, so we do whitewater rafting with friends and family and do a 4 or 5 day trip in the summer down the lower gorge of the Salmon at least once a year. This year probably 3 times because various people are coming out to do it at various times. I like outdoor stuff. I like hiking and fishing. I love reading. I am a lifelong addicted reader. My garden out here has become a real source of pleasure. I've got a vegetable garden with a deer fence. That's a fence that's at least 6 feet tall to keep the deer out. And then I've got a rock garden with flowers that so far I'm doing fairly well with deer, with varieties that deer aren't interested in. We'll see how that goes. My son is the joy of my life. My family, both in Michigan and, my brother out here, are real strong influence and source of joy. What I miss about what I'm doing now is teaching students. The high point of my career throughout has been teaching. And the second thing is, if you ask me at any point in my career, I almost always say I really like what I'm doing now. I love consulting. I feel like I'm teaching program directors and faculty instead of teaching students. And it's not quite the same, but it's very rewarding in its own way. So I always like what I'm doing at the time. The way that's similar is the quandary of being a PA student, like being a rookie program director. Rookie program directors are mostly what I'm working with, is having to learn a whole lot in a really short period of time, and, you know, the sort of drinking from the open fire hydrant phenomenon. The content is different, but the feeling of, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to master this, and help, much